All right, I guess let's go ahead and get started, right? We have this enormous auditorium, so feels a little formal being all the way up here. Maybe it can be a little more interactive than your average panel. So my name is Glenn. I work at YouTube now. I used to work at Creative Commons, which is an organization I'll tell you more about in the presentation. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about what's entitled here, Soundtrack Seeking Films, Songs in Search of Directors. And I'm basically going to talk about the different options that are out there now for getting music to use in video, whether you're a filmmaker, like a documentary filmmaker, or whether you're a video blogger, or whether you're a professional or not. I just want to ask real quick, are you all here for interactive? Is anybody here from film, or are you all here from interactive? Some interactive, how about hands? And film? Okay, cool. All right, so hopefully, there'll be elements of both. I want to start off by talking a little bit about sort of the background of how music rights work in general, sort of the history of how they got to where they are and why they're so complicated for filmmakers and, amateurs or professionals, and then go into some of the different options that are available now to try and get around some of those complications of getting rights cleared. I won't go too much into like every last example of where you can get royalty-free music or things like that. I'll give a couple of examples, but I was actually hoping that, especially if there's filmmakers in the audience or anybody who produces video, that we could actually talk about what the best resources are. I can point out a few, but I don't want to just laundry list kind of all the different options that are out there. I want to talk more about it from a kind of conceptual angle. So if there's any point in here when you see an example I put up and you say, oh, that example's crap, I have a better one, come up to the microphone and talk about, if you have an anecdote about sometime you tried to clear rights and you got around it through a certain way, I please invite you to step up to the mic and talk a little bit about it. So with that said, I want to start with the kind of historical angle. So this is Oliver Wendell Holmes, the Supreme Court Justice, and one of the more influential jurists in the U.S. history. And he has a famous saying that is kind of, I think, particularly apt for music rights. He wasn't talking about music rights, but I was talking about the law in general. And he said that the experience of the law is not one of logic. The path of the law is not one of logic, but of experience. And what he meant basically was that logic and reasoning were only going to get you so far through understanding what a country's laws were. You had to understand it from a historical perspective as sort of this accumulation of special interests in response to, technologies that come out or changes in the social landscape, et cetera. There was never enough just to kind of approach it logically. And I think it's particularly true for music rights that it's not something you can reason your way through. It's something that you kind of have to know what the big accumulation of special interests has been to be able to work through. So that's kind of one thing to keep in mind as we go through this. Another is, this is Andre 3000 from Outkast. And I put him in here to kind of represent, he has this amazing quote about, someone asked him about how he dresses. So this is a guy who, can match pearls with a handgun, right? So not too many people can do that. Someone asked him, who his fashion idols were, and he said, Sly Stone, Jackie O, and Ralph Lauren. And it actually makes a lot of sense when you look at them, you put those three together. And they said, but that's kind of breaking a lot of rules. And he said, well, to break the rules, you got to know the rules. There's a lot of guys out there who want to break the rules. But if you want to break the rules, you got to know the rules. And that's sort of kind of another theme we'll talk about here. Maybe not so much breaking the rules, but going around them. So the basic point to start with is, in every song, there's two copyrights pretty much. Sometimes there's more if the lyrics are separate and that sort of thing. But the thing to have in mind is that there's always going to be two you got to worry about. The composition, which is in its abstract, expression, the sheet music basically. It's the song. It's what the songwriter creates when they write a song. And then there's the sound recording, which is the actual output that is the MP3 or is the LP or that sort of thing. Confusingly enough, the P is the symbol for the sound recording, which is for phonograph, even though a lot of times they call it publishing on the composition side. I don't know how much of this is review, but I'm going to go through it anyway in case it's not for some people. So an example of what it looks like is Sam Cooke can write A Change Is Going to Come and record it himself. And so he'll be on both sides of the kind of copyright side here. Arcade Fire can cover that song, and they'll be on the sound recording side, even though he's on the composition side. So there can be examples of two copyright holders, which definitely complicates things for the film producer or movie maker. Making it even more complicated, usually it's a label on the sound recording side. It's not actually the artist. So it's actually a company on the sound recording side and then a songwriter/publishing company on the composition side. So you're dealing with multiple parties usually, And it, you know, sometimes not even the same, not even in the same corporation. So how did we get to that state of affairs where it's that kind of complicated? This is where the little history part comes in, and the path of the law being experience, not logic, comes in. So in the first Copyright Act, 1790, the only thing covered by copyright was books, maps, and charts. So music in any form wasn't copyrightable. So in 1814, Francis Scott Key writes the Star Spangled Banner. He actually didn't write the melody. He wrote the lyrics. He took the melody from this song, which was a British drinking song. It was literally a song you would hear in pubs and where people would drink to. And it was a, kind of an ode to this Dionysus-like Greek figure that was, you know, celebrating drinking. But there's basically not a copyright issue, right? Our national anthem is based on an English drinking song. It's kind of like a cover, but the guy rewrote the lyrics. But there was no music copyright at the time. That's kind of the point there. Not until 1870 was there an actual copyright for musical compositions for the songwriter side of things. Not until 1891 did the U.S. even kind of acknowledge foreign copyrights. Then in 1909, you get the first kind of modern Copyright Act, a lot of which is still in place today. And it basically lays out that there are exclusive rights in the copyright holders for both the composition and the sound recording. And then there's a weird thing that comes out of that too. Oh, and I should note that wherever I have stuff that appears in red in these rights, it basically means that it's the kind of right that's an absolute property right. So in this Copyright Act of 1909, to copy someone's sheet music or distribute it, or to copy someone's, at the time, piano roll or kind of sound cylinder or whatever, you had to have permission and you had to pay. So it was an absolute right. The copyright owner could say no if they didn't like you, if they didn't like the price you were setting or you were offering. And I'll distinguish that from the mechanical right, which is a weird wrinkle in the history of music copyrights. And you'll hear mechanicals kind of described. It's a mysterious kind of sounding term if you don't know really what it is. The basic point is it's a right to turn a composition into a sound recording. This will become relevant to the film part in a second, just if you just bear with me. So, and the idea is it's different from the rights in red in that it's sort of a pay-to-play rule. It's not about both compensation and control for the copyright holder. It's compensation without control. So basically, this is the rule that now allows anyone to make a cover of anybody else's song. You can take someone else's composition and turn it into your own sound recording. And roughly speaking, I'm fudging some of the details. You can do it without having to ask permission, provided you pay a statutory rate, you know, set by the Library of Congress. So it's a really unusual rule. In most areas of the law, there's not this kind of property rule where you can just basically live up to certain formalities and kind of pay a set rate, and then you get to do what you want, regardless of whether the copyright holder objects. So it's very unusual, and it came about because in around the time the 1999 Copyright Act passed, there was this company called Aeolian, which made player pianos, and they had basically the dominant kind of market position in the sound recording market. Sound recordings at the time being piano rolls, just cylinders that would tell a piano how to play a song. So what they did was when they saw the 1909 Copyright Act coming and they saw that they were going to get, they were going to have exclusive rights in those piano rolls, they started buying up all the popular compositions of the time. So they started going out to songwriting companies and publishers and saying, okay, Enrico Caruso, okay, I'm going to buy that stuff because basically if someone wants to listen to that song, they're going to have to buy my piano roll. So there's, you could maybe make an analogy to Microsoft in the 90s. Some people might make this analogy that it's the same sort of principle of trying to get people, trying to use your market power in one market where you dominate to boost yourself in another one. In this case, you know, the browser and the operating system. So what happened was in the 1909 Act, when they put these mechanicals in, they put in a right for any third party label. Once, say, Aeolian made their first piano roll for an Enrico Caruso song, anybody could then come in and make their own version of it. And that was the intent, was basically just to kind of prevent this player piano company from monopolizing these markets. And that is actually the root of why you can now cover somebody else's song. It's kind of a weird artifact of music history. So that's what it looks like in 1909. 1914 is John Philip Sousa. He gets mad that people are playing his songs in bars and restaurants, and he puts together ASCAP and basically lobbies successfully to get a performance right. So there's a new right added on, which is a similar kind of pay-to-play rule. Again, I'm fudging the details a little bit if you know about this stuff. But it's similar in that you don't have to ask permission before playing somebody's song in a bar or in a stadium or in this kind of venue. provided you kind of pay your daily fees, I mean, your annual fees to ASCAP and now BMI, which emerged later. But so basically, that's another rule that's kind of compensation without control. And I'll leave aside that because it gets complicated. It won't be directly relevant to the film stuff, but just to give you a sense of how this stuff works. In the 20s, then you get radio. Turns out there's not a performance right in the sound recording side, though today there's a big debate about that. If you watch the Grammys, the guy came out at the end, the kind of president of the Grammys, and said, the United States is the only developed country in the world that doesn't pay for the performance of sound recordings, meaning when something gets played on the radio, only the songwriter gets paid. So that's kind of a live debate now. Then this is the most relevant part for our purposes. With the advent of talkies, you get songwriters saying, wait a minute, actually, there's a different right you have to get for us to use our song in your movie. And they called it a synchronization right. And it's not something that appears in the statute anywhere. It basically developed out of custom and as an interpretation of sort of the right to copy. And it's basically saying that if you make a copy of my composition and the phrase is synchronize it in timed relation with motion pictures, then the term sync came out of that. Then you have to ask my permission and pay me whatever that I demand. So this is an absolute property rule, sync rights, which makes it complicated to get music for your movies. Same thing on the sound recording side. It's an absolute rule. It's kind of like the right to copy the sound recording, but with a different application. So that's kind of where the source of a lot of the tension comes from between trying to clear rights for video and not. It's not trying to get a song for your video is different from trying to cover it or a bunch of other different kinds of uses. It's an absolute kind of property rule where you have to ask permission and pay, and it's compensation and control for the songwriter, the copyright owner. So the bottom line is it's been at least this complicated since 1927. So because of this property right having kind of developed since talkies started, you now have to go and ask permission, you know, every time you want to use a composition in your song. And that's fine, but it's not the same kind of rule as public performance where you know, with ASCAP, where you just pay an annual fee when it kind of much less friction to get what you want. There's some other rights, like I said, that have developed since. There's webcasting stuff. There's a bunch of other issues, but I won't go into that for now. So just an example of how that the sync rules and all that affect filmmakers today. So here's an example from The Royal Tenenbaums. How many people have seen that movie? I assume pretty much everybody. So in the opening sequence, you know, there's they run down the family history and they play Hey Jude in the background, but it's actually an instrumental version of Hey Jude, and it's done by Mark Mothersbaugh. So it's not the Paul McCartney Beatles recording. And what had happened was the original cut of the movie had the original Beatles recording. And just before they were going to debut it here, actually, in Austin at the Paramount, they had to pull it because they realized that there was a little bit of a snafu with the rights clearance stuff. And so what happened was they had gotten the sync rights from the songwriter side, which is Michael Jackson, Sony ATV. It's a joint venture who own the composition rights. They got that part cleared, but then they didn't get the master cleared. So they didn't get the actual Beatles recording of it cleared, right? So very cleverly, they used the cover right basically to make their own version of the Hey Jude song by Mark Mothersbaugh. And by doing that, they got around having to clear the master from the Beatles, right? So now if you watch the movie, it starts off with an instrumental version. You see the credits. It's Mark Mothersbaugh and his orchestra. So that's a kind of a clever example of how you get around it. And the lesson there, again, is it's not something you can really reason your way through unless you know kind of what all the rules are. So then another lesson to take from it is, you know, if you're not Wes Anderson and your buddy's not Mark Mothersbaugh, you don't have access to producers that know this way around the kind of rules and stuff. Another lesson could be just for everyday filmmakers or video makers is you want stuff that is ready to use already. You're kind of pre-cleared on both sides, on the master and the publishing. And this is kind of where the soundtrack seeking film parts come in. You want to have things that are, you know, no assembly required or no assembly necessary, where you don't have to do a cover to get around this. You just basically want stuff to use. The first thing a lot of people think is, okay, we'll just get public domain stuff. And there are tons of public domain compositions, obviously. You know, there've been compositions, you know, they weren't a property right until 1870, but all those have gone to the public domain. The problem is there's very few sound recordings actually that are in the public domain because there weren't really commercial sound recordings available till the 20s, and the Copyright Act, the copyright that applies to those things in the 20s is still covering them. So it's actually really hard to find public domain sound recordings. So, I mean, you could do a cover of a public domain song or get a friend to do a cover of it. You could get a computer to play it, something like that. A lot of people do that sort of thing, and then you'd have some clearance. But most of the time, there's going to be some catch to it. I mean, the obvious one that a lot of people talk about is different royalty-free options. So there's no kind of assembly required here. You don't have to do a cover. You don't have to do any kind of extra rights clearance. And here's just an example of what a license agreement says from just GarageBand loops. Can I use GarageBand loops in commercial recordings? So they say, you may broadcast or distribute your own musical compositions or audio projects that were created using the audio content. However, individual audio loops may not be commercially or otherwise distributed on a standalone basis. That seems pretty fair. This is pretty typical language from GarageBand or iMovie or Final Cut if you have kind of libraries you buy for that. Here's an example of SoundVision, which is something that Final Cut actually links to in the sort of orientation materials around Final Cut. So you see it's royalty-free. Note how they point out there's a lifetime synchronization license if you pay the upfront fee, which is great. So you don't have to go back every time you reuse it for any of your movies. You can use it for all sorts of different kinds of clips. But so there's always going to be a catch, though. You got to pay upfront. That's fine. That's the kind of trade-off. It's not totally cheap, depending on what your budget is. This is the most affordable choice, $120. I think that's probably cheaper than a lot of stuff I see. But if there's, you know, filmmakers in the audience that can speak to this, I'd appreciate you to speak up, or producers or things like that. So what are the choices for no assembly required, no money required? There's definitely choices, but there's always kind of a big provided. So there's something that got a lot of press recently is Mobi is doing something called film music, and it calls it Mobi Gratis. And so if you go to Mobi's website, you see that he's made available a bunch of tracks that are available for free, provided it's, you know, using it for non-commercial purposes. So that's the one catch, okay? It's free, and there's no assembly required, but okay, it's not no commercial purposes. Seems fair. But the other thing is, he is also requiring that you actually ask him permission first. So this is no money required, no assembly required, but you do have to ask permission because he's worried about kind of uses that if it's something that's about cruelty to animals or if it's something about some other cause he cares about and he doesn't want his music associated with it, he wants to be able to pre-clear that. So this is a good option. It doesn't get you all the way there in that you still got to apply and wait to get the rights. So you basically it says the selected track must be approved for use prior to download. Please complete the form in order to be considered. You have to describe your entire film. It's not a terrible hoop to jump through, but it's a hoop if you're in a hurry, if you're on a tight deadline or something. So are there any examples of no assembly, no money, no permission required? One example is Creative Commons. I don't know how many of you know about Creative Commons. Show of hands. Okay, quite a lot. Good. So I don't have to explain too much of it. But this is a useful page that they have. Here's the URL where they have links to a bunch of different sites. You can see in the bottom left-hand corner that have video-ready music. And I guess the point here is, again, there's always going to be an asterisk. Can you use it for all purposes? Well, there's a few different conditions. It isn't free for all uses, only some. It depends on what the license is. You can't use Creative Commons stuff that's under a no derivative works license. Technically, a sync is not really a derivative work, but that's how they defined it for these purposes, just to make clear to people that's an option they can't use the no derivatives license for. And then you have to be sure to credit the musician and the track properly, which, again, all pretty small hoops to jump through. But there are things you got to keep in mind. There's always going to be some kind of asterisk to the free stuff. So these are the different conditions that might apply. You know, you have to give the author credit. You can't use it for commercial purposes, or you have to, if you include it in your video, you have to share your video under the same terms that you got the license under. So if I write a song and put it under a Creative Commons license that's attribution, non-commercial, share alike, and you put it in your movie, the share alike part makes you obligated to share it under the same terms with the public. So an example of, I love this example because it's an example of a sample that was up on this Free Sound Project website that was Creative Commons licensed. You see this sample is part of a sample pack called Screams and Pain, which is kind of amusing. This was actually under a license that restricted some commercial uses, but it ended up actually in Children of Men. If you watch the credits in Children of Men, they credit Freesound for this. And so even though it had a commercial restriction on it, basically what happened was some producer or sound editor was looking around for samples. They needed a man screaming, and they came across Freesound and saw it. Then they saw that it was actually had some commercial restrictions on it. And they actually just bought the sample. So even though it was under Creative Commons license, you could still end up buying it. And the person who created the sound effect could still make money. The same is true for music. You could put it out there for people to use for non-commercial purposes. But then as soon as they want to use it for commercial purposes, you know, you charge them money, which seems perfectly fair and is probably a pretty good source of new business for people like Moby doing that gratis site, where, you know, if you basically let student filmmakers or people on the festival circuit use your music, and then once they kind of start making money off of it, then you can charge them for it. That's not really how the law works. The law says it's copyright infringement whether you're using it commercially or not. You got to get permission. But these people are kind of building their own kind of alternative around it. You have a question in the back? It's as far as Creative Commons is concerned, or as far as copyright is concerned? Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's hard to define. I think that Creative Commons defines it as the law is not a great guide in terms of the baseline law, again, because it's considered infringement whether or not there's any kind of monetary aspect to it. The damages might be different depending on if you're making money, but it still could be infringement. Creative Commons defines it as direct monetary or financial gain with use of the work. So, and then they specifically carve out things like file sharing is not commercial use if it's under Creative Commons license. But basically, it has to involve the exchange of money. But it's a hard thing to define. I think that it ends up being, like a lot of things in this area, more of a practical measure than anything else. Will people actually care? Is it worth their while to sue? Basically, that's how it really works most of the time in the world. Like, people don't really care until you make money off something, or really to make enough money off something to make it worth their while to sue you is another way to look at it. So it's not the clearest answer I know, but that's kind of the state of things. So this is just an example, again, of Children of Men using the Creative Commons licenses and, you know, actually buying the rights to it to be able to use it commercially. So another example of kind of no assembly or money or permission required, at least from the user side or the filmmaker side, is so I'm from YouTube. I have to talk a little bit about this. It's a thing we have called AudioSwap. It's basically an online library of tracks that we've cleared with the record label. So you see down there where it says copyright owner, that's Wind Up Records. We basically do a deal with a record label where they give us all their music videos and we, you know, put ads on those and they run on the site just like you normally see. That's pretty straightforward, but they will also give us a license to their sound recordings. And then we also go out and clear the publishing with the publishers, and we put it in here and basically let users put that audio in their video, and then that becomes monetizable. Yeah. So if it's on YouTube, yes. So that's why it's not downloadable, right? But there's two kind of paths to ending up with a video that has has an ad on it that pays the rights holder and it doesn't get taken down. This is one path. Another path is you just upload something and we happen to have a license for it, and then we're clear. But it's really challenging right now because, one, we're having to go out and clear the sound recordings and the publishing separately. So the inventory there doesn't always match up, and we won't actually put ads on a video until we have all the rights cleared, both sides. And also, it's not entirely, depending on sort of our partner, they're more or less clear about telling users about what they can and can't use. So here's a good example of, you know, you can use that one, right? But in some cases, we're not getting that much clarity from them, and we kind of know after the fact. So that's the ultimate goal. So that's, this is sort of kind of the theme of, I'll describe that in a second, but the ultimate goal is to have a version of this where pretty much anybody who can vouch for it, or any record label who can vouch for it, can put their song in here. And you have basically a browsable library where when you come onto YouTube, you could actually just check stuff out. It depends a little bit on having a better online editor, which we don't have yet. This is a kind of a blunt tool right now, but it definitely demonstrates the point of what we're shooting for. We're shooting for sort of browsable online library. Maybe even people are feeding stuff in XML feeds of audio, of clip, you know, of public domain footage, of, you know, still images, stuff like that. That's the kind of ultimate goal, I think. It's just hard to get there. And you know, the idea of the one thing we're going around saying a lot is it's crazy for every song not to have a video now. If you're a small record label and it's really expensive to produce videos, it's something that generally has been kind of a privilege of major labels with big budgets and big marketing budgets, that it's crazy now when everybody can make a video and, you know, it's easy to make a video and you can put it on YouTube, not to have videos for every song, not to have at least one video for every song. So what we're doing with, you know, you saw that Wind Up Records example is, again, getting the rights to the audio stuff so then our users can make videos basically for the label, and the label will end up getting paid for it. And this is kind of what it looks like when you see, you know, this is obviously a homemade video. It's Put a Little Love in Your Heart, made by Cassandra. This is a real example on YouTube. So you see the ad on the upper right-hand corner. There's not usually ads on YouTube videos unless we know who the copyright owner is and we've done a deal with them. So that ad is only there because we actually identified this audio track in this video using this new kind of ID technology we use, and Audible Magic is the one you may have heard of. Once we identify it, we go and check, did we have a deal with the record label? And if do they want that taken down or do they want it up? If they want it up, then we'll put an ad on it and split the revenue with them. And this is something that we want to see more and more of and make it more seamless. And particularly, again, to make it clearer on the side for when the video maker is putting their stuff up, so they have a clear idea beforehand rather than after the fact. Right now, it's a little bit after the fact, but we're, again, trying to make sure that our partners are clear up front with the users. So that's kind of an example of what we'd like to see more and more of on the site. And now we can basically have links back to the actual record label and stuff like that on this page once it's been kind of claimed. So the latest example, you probably read about Nine Inch Nails putting out their 36-track album of instrumentals called Ghosts under a Creative Commons license. So they have the benefit of they have an easier time clearing the rights to that to be able to Creative Commons license it because they're no longer on a label. They left Interscope, they left Universal. So they have control of both sides, which is unusual, especially for a big name. This is a quote from Trent Reznor when they put it out, which I think is really fits the theme of sort of soundtrack seeking directors. She says, I've been considering and wanting to make this kind of record for years, but by its very nature, it wouldn't have made sense until this point. This collection of music is the result of working from a very visual perspective, addressing imagined locations and scenarios of sound and texture, a soundtrack for daydreams. I'm very pleased with this result and the ability to present it directly without interference. So he's basically putting it out there saying, it's under this Creative Commons license. Do with it what you will, you know, with certain conditions in place. And I just wanted to end here and then, you know, open it up for discussion by showing you an example of something that's already kind of shown up on YouTube, which is this particular video from the album Ghosts. And if you see here, this is the part I love about it. It's made by a regular old user here. And what they say in the description field is, this is what I saw in my head when I listened to it, which is a lot like what Trent Reznor exactly was going for when he says it's a soundtrack for daydreams. So let me just play a little bit of this. Get a little bit of a weird display on this projector, but it still works. An idea. There's some static there on the connection, but so basically, when we kind of finish all the kind of dotting the I's, crossing the T's of our partnership with Nine Inch Nails, then we'll have, you know, we'll be able to claim this using the audio identification, and we'll put an ad on it if they want to, and then they'll end up getting paid for it. And the idea is, they're, you know, in exchange for letting their fans make all this stuff, we're making sure that they get compensated for that. And I think that's a model that you'll see more and more of. Is it'll be free to the filmmaker or the end user. Someone else will be sponsoring that, though. And that'll probably mean some advertising in some cases. But the experience of having to clear the rights will become less and less of an issue for the person actually making it, and more of an issue for whoever's kind of hosting the environment in which they're doing that. So that's pretty much it. I wanted to kind of open it up. Like I said at the beginning, that I didn't want to go down a laundry list of like places to find royalty-free music, or, you know, a billion anecdotes about what it's like to clear rights. But I was hoping that, you know, if you guys have some examples of a particular time you had trouble clearing a particular right, or some time you found, you know, a good, if you know of a particularly good audio resource for this sort of thing, I'd be happy to happy to talk about that and answer any other questions you might have. So thanks. Yeah. Thanks. Sure. Okay. Sure. Yeah, I can. And actually used to work there. So, about 3 years ago. So, yeah, it's a good point. So Creative Commons is voluntary to the extent that, it's obviously not trying to change the law or anything like that. It's basically all based on these agreements between the copyright owner and whoever ends up accepting the license. In that sense, it's voluntary, meaning that we're not trying to change how the law, or we weren't trying to change how the law works. It's basically just a tool that anybody can use if they want to. It is enforceable though, under the law. So it is an actual enforceable agreement. And there have actually been cases of, I don't think there's been one yet in the States of this happening, but Adam Curry, the former MTV VJ guy, had a case where someone had used some of his stuff that was under Creative Commons license. I think it was in Holland. And he actually sued because they didn't follow the sort of asterisk, the sort of, yeah, but these conditions, not commercial, you have to credit me. He actually did sue and won in court there. And I think there was a similar case in Spain a few years ago. So it has actually been held enforceable in places, and it does have the force of law. That doesn't get you around the problem of, well, you still got to sue or threaten to sue or make clear to somebody, hey, this isn't just kind of like a superstitious token I'm putting on my website. It actually means something, right? I mean, I think it's a really important point, though, is it is voluntary, but at the same time, you know, all contracts are voluntary, and it's a kind of a contract. And so if someone sees that they, you know, there's a Creative Commons license on your stuff, and they use it, they accept the license by using it, because otherwise they'd be in violation of the copyright law. And if they can't abide by the terms on it, then they're either in violation of copyright law or they've breached the agreement. Right. So you can still use the kind of tools that are under, you know, regular law to enforce that stuff. In fact, you would actually technically, from a lawyer point of view, you would actually sue for copyright infringement more than breach of contract, because you'd say you didn't accept the terms of the license. Therefore, you're violating my copyright. So hope that helps. Yeah. I don't know. I'd have to look that up. We have deals with a lot of the major music publishers. We don't have deals with all of the whole publishing industry yet. Parts of the publishing industry are suing us. We're hoping that, you know, we'll be able to work something out with them, but they haven't been talking to us lately. I don't know if Happy Birthday is covered or not. I have to look that up. Yeah, no, it would be huge. It would be huge. Another thing I really, really want to do with the publishing side of things is, I mean, it would be amazing if YouTube could do this. It's happening in different places, but YouTube seems like a logical place for it to me, would be do direct deals with publishers to where we would get basically the karaoke versions of the songs, right? So there's no record label involved. You get the lyrics that scroll just like you see in your karaoke lounge, right? And then have, you know, maybe some trick on the site or some little tool on the site that lets people record themselves singing into their computer webcam. All that stuff gets uploaded. You know, all that stuff gets ads put on it. And next thing you know, you have like 10,000 versions of My Way, and they all have ads, and all that money goes back to, I guess it's the estate of Paul Anka now. I don't know if he's Paul Anka alive. I don't know. Yeah, he is. Okay, great. So it goes to Paul Anka, even better. But that's something I really want to do, is just basically, you know, get exactly what you're talking about. Sing-along is a huge part of YouTube, right? And most people don't have any idea that implicates rights. Why would they? It's kind of crazy. I mean, I'm not saying it's wrong or anything, but it's just it's a big gulf between your everyday life and kind of what the rules are, right? So, yeah. Sing Shot, yeah, that's a really cool site. Yeah, yeah. that's a great referral sing shot. That's a good karaoke site. So yeah. You know, I guess Google's kind of religious about not pre-announcing stuff, but we're working on it. It's a high priority, and especially for this kind of stuff, it'll enable a lot more of these kinds of deals with record labels and songwriters, and users really want it. And there's a few examples out there that I've seen, like that are pretty cool, that are startup companies, like there's one called, I think, Kaltura with a K, and another one called Ad It All, but that's focused on kind of ads, but they have on making your own ad or whatever. So there's a few out there. I think it's bubbling up, and we'll eventually have something, hopefully really soon. We'll see. So yeah. Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that. I should have neglected to mention that. So we do have, Wind Up Records is an example of independent. We have deals with the aggregators for independents, like IOTA and The Orchard, or DMGI, which basically serve as sort of intermediaries that go out to the independent market and say, we'll get you on iTunes, we'll get you on YouTube. And then they administer all the payments, because with that many players, it's hard to administer all that. So we're doing that, but we have a new page up now, actually, that's youtube.com/musicpartners, that has, I can pull it up if this is working okay. I'm pretty sure it's music partners or partnerships that describes, yeah, here it is. Again, the screen is kind of stretched, but it describes, you know, we have an alias here where you can write in if you want to do a deal on the independent side. And that's pretty much like what my job and a colleague of my job, mine's job is now. So we're definitely in business for that. So, yeah. And I think, again, it's a particularly cool application for independence, because if you have a catalog of stuff that you don't have videos for, it's a way to make money off of that, you know, and the clearer you are with your fans about what they can use, then the better, you know, the better your odds are of making revenue off that or getting videos made. The trick is the publishing. I mean, it's really hard. And unless you control it yourself, in which case we're in business right away, like Nine Inch Nails, right? But otherwise, then we have to go about going to the publishers, the ones who aren't suing us, and matching up their rights with the, you know, master rights, as you know, I'm sure. So, right. Yeah, it is. And there's the way our contract's written, if you want to kind of geek out on how the contracts work, is it's kind of modular. So the main body of the contract talks about produced videos or MTV style videos. So that's the straightforward license. And then another section of it talks about sound recordings and masters. And then if you have the publishing, there's a kind of a modular part that plugs in that says, and to the extent I have publishing, here's the license, here are the rates, et cetera. So, yeah. Yeah. Right. It's a really good question. So under the statute of the statutory definition of derivative works, almost anything's a derivative work. So it's not a very helpful definition, right? It's basically any kind of alteration is considered a derivative work, unless you go so far as to transform it completely in a way that's fair use, right? So I'm not entirely sure. I can look it up real quick. The Creative Commons definition of what a derivative work was used to be based on the statutory definition. But I think they might have had built in more kind of leeway. So here's how you pick a license, right? You guys have maybe done this before. So I'm picking no modifications, which is the same thing as no derivative works. We'll see if they actually define it somewhat more broadly than the way the Copyright Act does. Because it'd be nice to build in a little give. It's just really hard to define. When you get down to actually drafting, well, what kind of modification do you want to allow? You know, maybe reformatting is cool. You know, reformatting for archival purposes is cool. So let's see the full license. See if I can still remember where this language is. Bear with me here. So you'll see here in the license grant, it's got all the stuff about mechanical rights and performance rights that we talked about at the beginning. So restrictions. I may not be able to find it here. It's been a long time since I've looked at this. No, it's actually the way it's actually defined, it's still based on the baseline laws, because the way the license works is it doesn't give you the right to create derivative works. And so it's silent on that point, meaning the copyright law fills in, meaning it's based on the definition of derivative works. I can double check on that, but I'm almost positive that's how it works. So, but it's a hard question. I think, you know, again, it comes down to pragmatics, like how much is someone going to care if you cut a little bit out of something? If you, you know, if you take the key part of their really cool photograph on Flickr and just cut down that part and they said no derivatives, like just somebody's eyeball and it's a portrait, probably someone who has, you know, a sense of artistry is going to care about that. If you're actually changing it by a few pixels to fit into your blog post, meh. Again, pragmatically, they're probably not going to care. Yeah, well, so the way it works is the way they define the sync in these licenses is if it's a no derivative license, you can't use it in a video anyway. So, but so if you have the right to be able to sync it, you probably have the right to be able to edit it down. Is the good news. Yeah. Right. That's a great question. So could you all hear that? Basically, if there's more than one rights holder on, like within the composition side or within the sound recording side, in which case you may end up having four rights holders or more if it's a mashup or a remix. The agreements that we're striking contemplate that, basically like a pro rata kind of share. The trick is, again, like now we're dealing with four times the rights holders, you know, and how we administer that and how we build that into the content ID stuff. It's definitely part of the plan to be able to enable that. And, you know, legally speaking, on the contracts, it's already kind of baked into our agreements. The question is how we're going to make it practical. If it's two songs out of the audio player, I mean, it depends on which ones and, you know, what the agreements were with those particular people. I'm sorry. It's, again, we're in this kind of weird period now between, you know, 5 years ago, or even just 3 years ago, all this stuff would have been frowned upon by our music partners. Probably, you know, they probably just wouldn't have allowed it to happen. Then 2 years ago, starting with Warner Music, they start in kind of embracing the idea of users and video makers putting their music in videos, even if they didn't necessarily ask permission to begin with, at least with respect to YouTube, because we're paying them. And, you know, the end game, like I said, is an online library where all this stuff is really transparent. Getting there is a lot of growing pains of kind of getting them to be clear with us, getting them to be clear with the users. And so that's why a lot of my answers on those specific questions, I can't be that clear on yet. So that's just kind of the unfortunate interim period. So, yeah. That's a really good question. So the question is, if you go independent as a composer or as a musician, how do you get your stuff found? I think it's a really hard question. I think that like that's the question that's not being addressed by like the Radioheads and the Nine Inch Nails going out. Like they have their brand that they built up in the system, right? And so they have the advantage of the name recognition and people seeking out their stuff when they put out just a single press release. And not everybody's that fortunate. I mean, I think that when these kinds of tools are more widespread and a little bit easier to use, like the audio swap thing I described, you know, getting in as many of those as possible, competing on kind of making it attractive to filmmakers in other ways, like if you offer less restrictions or maybe your price is lower for, you know, certain kinds of sync rights or things like that. I think the thing that Moby's doing is cool in that, you know, getting people hooked on your music and then charging them for it once they do something commercial with it is pretty clever. He's not doing Creative Commons, but it's a similar kind of concept. He just had that kind of moral concerns about how people use their stuff. So that's why he didn't feel comfortable doing the Creative Commons license. But I guess to answer your question, I mean, it's the sort of magic, the magic trick of the internet, of making money off the internet, which is how do you turn, first of all, how do you get really lots of exposure, and then how do you turn that exposure into money? And it's the ads market in search is really mature and makes a lot of money. The ads market in music and video and stuff like that is still really new. And so that sort of magic question of how do you turn the eyeballs into money is not yet. I would say, you know, just for starters, though, just try and get your name and your work out as many places as possible. But no, that's there's not a formula. It's whatever you can get. So, if I make a movie, I want to use your song. You can tell me, pay me $10 million or I won't give it to you. And then we can negotiate over that. I don't have anything else to fall back on, though. If you don't want to give it to me for less than $10 million, that's it. If I then get it from you for $10 million, then we talk about how broad the scope of the sync right is. So can I use it in my movie? Yes. Can I use it in the DVD? I don't know. Maybe you add a couple million dollars extra on for that. Can I use it on online rights? I mean, if I'm smart as the producer, I'm asking for all this stuff up front, right? Because you don't want to get stuck where when you put the DVD out, you can't use the song anymore, which has happened, right? And so, you know, then you're just talking about the scope of the sync. Can I use it around the world? Do I have to pay anybody else? Are there any co-writers? It's got to be. I think a great resource is a book called Cone on Music Licensing. If you ever see it, it's really intimidating because it's like that big. And the second half of it is all really nitty gritty legal forms and stuff like that. But it's a great book in that it lays out in a sort of in the same way that I did at the beginning. And in fact, I kind of ripped it off from that book. The historical kind of how the rights built up. And it basically tells a story. So then you're like, oh, okay, that's where the rights came from. And then it has the more practical half of the book, which is, so you're negotiating a license. Ask about these things. It's a really good handbook. It's expensive, but you could, if you have a friend who's a lawyer and they have a law library, you can borrow it from them or something. It's called Cone, K-O-H-N, on music licensing. Yeah. Thanks. Right. Okay. Fantones.com. And you say you bring fans and bands and brands together. So what's the brand part is interesting because that's definitely part of what we're doing too, YouTube. I mean, what is their role in there? Are you finding sponsors for bands so that fans can take stuff for free? Okay. Right. Yeah. So that's something you see a lot more of, like I said, is like one business paying another business so that the end user doesn't have to pay is becoming, I think, much more of a daily thing. And it's always been the magazine model, right? But it's now becoming more of the kind of rich media model, I think, too. Yep. Yeah, I mean, like I said, we have deals with all the major labels, and we're a growing bunch of indies, and then most of the major publishers, and we're trying to get into the indie publishers. But again, you know, I don't know if anybody know what Harry Fox is, but they're the agency that does a lot of the administration of this kind of right for independent publishers. They won't deal with us. We're not getting along for whatever reason, and we really want to get all that stuff licensed so we can actually pay on all this stuff. So it makes it hard. If we don't get those rights, we can't actually pay the labels for a lot of the stuff too. And so a lot of stuff gets taken down, even if the label wants it up to be able to make money from it. So it's a thorny issue. Yeah. They won't touch it, meaning they won't pay for it or? I see. So yeah, there's a lot of different battles going on right now in that area. And, you know, publishers and labels are disagreeing over what the value of a mechanical is right now too. So, sorry, go ahead. Yeah. Not yet. That's something we want to work with Creative Commons on, actually. They've got a new thing that they're calling like CC Plus, where you've seen that? Yeah. So that's something that we'd like to end up doing. You know, not only building in the Creative Commons licensing into the system, but having a way for people to get you know, a copy of it or buy a copy of it. And you know, one thing you can imagine and that we're hoping to, well, I can't talk about it too much, but yeah, it's something we're interested in. Unfortunately. But yeah, look for something like that soon. Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. Like a set rate? Yeah, so that's a good question. So are you saying, like, would you want to agree with, like, say, a community of filmmakers on what the rate would be for the Plus? Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, if it's like the crown jewels you're talking about, you may want to wait and see, right? Because then you get the benefit of the Creative Commons license for the exposure part, and then you can always wait. If you end up getting interest by somebody you didn't expect, like some huge corporation that has tons of money and plans on making tons of money off your stuff, you'll probably be glad that you didn't set a flat rate for that, right? On the other hand, if it's something that is maybe not the crown jewels, it's some kind of thing that's been sitting on the shelf for a while, or that's a one-off, or maybe some B-roll footage or a B-side if it's music, then it might be interesting to say, like, any taker, $20 or $200 or whatever, right? Because then you know, the cost of negotiating it out for smaller players like that is not worth what you're going to get for it, right? If it's a smaller kind of asset. But if it's the crown jewels, if it's the thing you know, if it's your masterpiece, then it probably will be worth negotiating it out with the big bad company that wants to come buy it. I guess that's much more of a personal question, right? Like if there's certain, I guess like along the lines of Mobi, if there's certain uses you don't want to allow, like there's a particular cause you don't want your stuff used with, then that's totally up to you, right? And I think that if you just have a strong feeling about, you know, no military, you know, use of this, or that's one that comes up a lot. My brother's in the military, so it's not one that I have, but that's an example I hear a lot. No cruelty to animals, no advertising. You know, use it commercially, but not for actually shilling. That's another one you hear a lot of. I would say that one's more kind of personal. So, yeah. So, I don't know where we are on time. I guess we're 5 more minutes. Okay. So, we can keep talking about stuff. Yeah. Yeah, it can happen simultaneously, and it comes down to the non-commercial, whether or not you've picked non-commercial or not. It can work together. So if it turns out, most people with a BMI agreement with BMI or ASCAP are like stadiums, bars, places like this. Most of them are making commercial use of their stuff, probably in that they're probably charging attendance or they're making money off something else, right? And so even if you had it under a non-commercial license, you're probably not waiving your royalties in that case. Probably not. Again, it depends on the particular case. But the idea is if you pick, you know, non-commercial, you're basically saying that you're waiving any royalties you're entitled to if the use is non-commercial. That includes public performance royalties. There have actually been fights about that in Europe too. There was a couple cases in Spain about that, about whether there's a cafe that was playing all Creative Commons licensed music, and whether they had to pay the public performance fees for that. So you can look at, there's all this stuff's on the Creative Commons website if you're curious about it. So, yeah. Right. So that's a really good point. I mean, that even though Moby's not doing that with all of his music, he probably has a pretty strong sideline, if not even a sideline, in licensing the major label stuff or major publisher stuff he has. And that isn't under the same kind of rules. I think that's a really good point. I guess people are just experimenting with hybrids, right? Some people are keeping their, you know, to the extent they can negotiate with a major to let them do sidelines. It's usually only powerful people that can do that, or upstarts who have the kind of guts to negotiate that for themselves. Then they can, you know, experiment with the models on one side that are commercial and then the non-commercial ones on the other. And I mean, you see that in the obvious kind of example is the Nine Inch Nails or the Radiohead sort of pay what you want, hear the different price tiers and stuff like that. I think the hybrid thing is the kind of future of a lot of this stuff. Now, I think because everyone's looking for like the magic bullet on this, and there's not going to be the single answer on how to make money off this stuff or how to control your stuff. You're going to have to keep experimenting with like 18 different ways of doing it, and it takes a lot of time. But yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that it's hard to do, I guess, sometimes, and this kind of brings it full. I'll end it with a couple anecdotes that bring it back to where we started with the Royal Tenenbaums example. Like, from what I've read, like, Wes Anderson will write scenes with a song in mind before he's writing the scene. He's like, oh, and they're going to be, and it makes sense. Like, the Hey Jude is a perfect pick for that because it's all, the song is supposedly about John Lennon being crappy to his kids. Supposedly, it's one of the, you know, one of the myths about it or folklore legends about it. And the whole movie, you know, from there on out is about this guy being crappy to his kids. So that's really hard if that's the way you work creatively. And it's kind of an unfortunate fact of how these rights clearance things work. And we're out of time, so I won't tell the other anecdote, which is not nearly as interesting. So that's it. Thanks a lot, y'all.